Before I introduce the second panel, I would like to make a personal apology. At the beginning of the conference, when I introduced Professor Julia Black as director of the LSE, I was also supposed to introduce Roberto Sowaczak, who is the head of LATAM Equities for Citigroup, Citi being our main sponsor for this event, a considerable institutional and personal oversight. I do apologise to everybody in the room, particularly to Mr. Sowaczak for that error. And hopefully we can make amends for that in the course of the morning. The second panel is on key infrastructure projects, latest developments and outlook. It's already been cross-referenced in the excellent first panel. The moderator for this panel is Professor Ricky Burdett on the end there, who is Professor of Urban Studies and Director of LSE Cities and the Urban Age Programme here at the school. Again, amongst a long list of publications, prizes and accolades, he is been involved in a number of regeneration projects across Europe and the United States, and was chief advisor on architecture and urbanism for the London 2012 Olympics, and architectural advisor to the Mayor of London from 2001 to 2006. He has also been, until very recently, a member of the UK government's Independent Airports Commission, from 2012 to 2015, which has been a very important and lively public debate in the UK for many years. I will pass the microphone to Ricky to introduce his speakers and panellists. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And what I'd like to do is be as brief as possible in my introductions. I think everyone's CVs are well known here. We've already heard in the first panel how important in the country of Colombia the issue of productivity is, and I think this panel is going to address, through the focus on infrastructure, one of the key ways of improving productivity through connectivity. And really, I can't think of four people who are more important and relevant, possibly the foremost important people and institutions who are more relevant to having this discussion with you here in London. Because effectively, we have Clemente del Valle, who will give in a moment a presentation, who runs CEO of the Financiera del Desarrollo Nacional, the FDN, which is a private conglomerate which is responsible for effectively promoting, generating funds to support all the major initiatives which are going ahead in the country in infrastructure, railway, aerospace, maritime, energy, and also education and health. So that's an interesting issue for us to address. And then if you think of what are the major areas of infrastructure that one can think of anywhere in the world, in any country, the issue of literally physical things, such as concrete and cement. We have Jorge next to me, who runs the Grupo Argos, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, group that does investment in investment energy. In fact, one of your subsidiaries has 500,000 home users for energy. We have next to him, going back to the airport introduction that was made, the president of Avianca, Hernan Rincon, the major airline in the country, clearly fundamental to connectivity in more ways than one. And then Felipe Bayon, who's the executive vice president of the state oil company, which is responsible for oil and gas, in fact, of Ecopetrol. So we have really four different voices which are responsible and key actors in the infrastructure program of the country. I just want to say two things before Clemente will give his presentation about the country itself. Not unlike Tim, I'm not an expert in Colombia, but I've had an occasion to particularly witness some of the success stories in Medellin and in Bogota of urban infrastructure with social impact. And I think that's something which is so important for all of us in this room to reflect on. You know, infrastructure is not neutral. It does things, it can help things, it can sometimes even things make things worse. But the two examples that I've cited, and there are many more in Colombia, have been enormously successful and are exemplars around the world of linking a social agenda with a sort of economic agenda, which I think is very, very interesting. The other thing to remember is that, of course, Colombia is an extraordinarily beautiful, rich, large country, but it's actually physically uneven. That the whole point that it has Pacific, Atlantic, Caribbean, and other sort of frontages, it has an Amazonian side, it has an Andean side, means that the country is actually quite disconnected. That's part of its beauty, you could say. That's what you go and see. So actually making those connections in this vast territory is fundamental. So if we take those two issues as extraordinary challenges, we're going to hear in a moment what the opportunities are and what the ambitions are from one of the key players. So Clemente de Valle, thank you very much for joining us. And if you can speak from the stage, that would be great. Unfortunately, we're going to have to crane our necks and look here to the right. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Rick. Let me first obviously thank the Stock Exchange of Colombia, Citi, and the LSE, which I'm also one of the alumnis from LSE, mid-80s, you know, when this was only the old building. Now we have these great new facilities that you have. My task is to do a brief introduction of how the infrastructure program is going in Colombia, and I wanted to start making a reference to the institutional transformation that is being developed in Colombia. Clearly, energy in the mid-90s, there was a big transformation of energy. We privatized mostly the system, and I think Colombia is today one of the countries in the region with the most stable, self-sustained system of energy. However, transportation was our biggest bottleneck because we actually had the wrong institutional framework, and we didn't do much over the last 20 years. And that's why we had a huge backlog in infrastructure. The connectivity between the big cities and the port was lousy. In general, connectivity even to far areas of the country because of the peace situation was also impossible. So now we have a huge opportunity. And we're starting with the framework. I mean, I agree, you were the previous moderator was referring to what the UK is doing in terms of transforming its institutionality to help that. And we have started. I mean, this government particularly invested 6 years to start transforming that institutionality, creating new institutions. I mean, the PPP agency, FDN, which we are not a private sector institution, we're a mixed institution, partly government, partly private, partly multilateral. So we are probably one of the new breed of development institutions in the world. I mean, actually, we are a pilot for the World Bank because there are not many of these institutions that have private and public in the same and trying to do development as well as keeping return in the mind. And one of the interesting things, and you can see it in the graph, is we're also starting to think big. Colombia in transportation was always thinking small. We were always doing small investments over time, and that's why we had this huge backlog. So for the first time, partly because we have the institutionality that we did not have before, we started to think big. And the first part was our initial program, what we call the 4G program. As you can see, it was largely roads. I mean, and Mr. Rincon will probably complain about that we were not putting enough attention in other parts of the infrastructure, but clearly roads was a huge backlog, and that's where the emphasis of 4G was. However, now we're starting to think also big on what we need going forward. I mean, and you can see our pipeline, the one that we're starting to develop, and this does not include energy. If we were to include energy, we'll probably have 40, 50 billion more to add for the next 5 to 10 years. So our pipeline is really building up, and it's a huge pipeline. I mean, from this $15 billion small pipeline that we have to start with, now we're talking about pipeline that could be between $70 and $100 billion for the next 5 to 10 years. And I think that also help us think on all the amount of work that needs to be done in Colombia. And the fact that we have a new framework gives us more confidence that we are going to be able to achieve it. Clearly, one of our challenges is going to be sources of payment. How do you pay for this? We can get the financing, we can get the banks, and I'll show you what we're doing with 4G, where we had the financing, sure. But for the bigger program, we still have to work a lot to get it really effective. So I had this slide for Mr. Rincon, I mean, clearly showing how the growth in demand, the average growth in demand of passengers, particularly passengers, has been huge, you know, over the last two decades. Cargo has also increased, but not as much as passengers. And you see the increase in the investments, by especially by private sector, is relatively small. Although it's been significant from what we had in the past, it's still relatively small to the size of the growth of demand. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an important issue going forward. But I'll focus a bit on 4G, because 4G today is really our largest program. And in the next two, three, 4 years, is going to be one of the main sources of growth for the country. And that's why it's important that I can update you on how that program is doing. It's mentioned before by Milena, you know, the impact. This is only the core bone of the highway system of Colombia, just connecting the main cities with the main ports. And there's a huge amount of other needs of roads, especially going to areas where historically were not accessible to the state because of the peace situation. And that will have obviously important impacts. I mean, 30% in travel times, and the cost, the direct cost for users is probably going to generate a 20% reduction in costs. So this is a 6,500 kilometers. And is in depending on the exchange rates, is between $18 and $19 billion. It's actually the largest toll road program in the emerging markets today. I mean, obviously excluding India and China, which are obviously of a very different size. And although it looks small, 32 projects, we consciously did it like this. We decided to do very large projects. Instead of multiple, like India did, they did small $40, $50 million projects. We're doing $500 million projects, and we're doing less, but significantly higher, because we wanted to attract financing, and we wanted to attract sponsors. And the only way to attract international players was to do bigger projects, and that's basically the design that we do. And we split them between what we have called the government-sponsored projects, there are 20 of those 32, and 12 that are what is called unsolicited proposals, but it's basically private initiative, government-supported or government-endorsed. How are we doing? I mean, out of those 32, 31 have been awarded, there's only one pending awarding, and it's probably going to be done in the next few weeks. Out of those, 23 of those projects already have a significant level of assurance of financing, but only 8 have formally closed, financial close with loans, bonds, credits actually signed. What is interesting, and that's, I guess, in some way that explains the role of FDN. FDN is an institution that was created to mobilize resources. We were not created, maybe we were not inspired in BNDES in Brazil, we were not inspired in a huge development bank that would put 70 or 80% of financing. No, we were inspired much more in IUC as an institution that is there to facilitate other sources of financing to come in. So the way we have developed our products and we have developed our approach is how can we help capital markets, how can we help international banks, how we can help local capital markets to actually crowd in to finance this huge program. We are happy and very satisfied with the first results. You know, the first 8 projects that have raised over $4 billion had a very interesting mix of sources, as you can see in the graph. What maybe people thought 2-3 years ago that this was going to be financed primarily by local banks, given that this was roads, and this is usually local revenue related. We were able to start already with an interesting diversification. We got international sources representing close to 21% of the financing. We got institutional investors also contributing with close to 22%. And local banks even they had a bigger concentration of around 49%, we were also able to expand the universe of banks. I mean, we have here a CEO of one of the banks that maybe 4 or 5 years was focusing only on housing and not really on infrastructure, and now they have become also a very important player because we were able to expand the universe of local banks that had done traditional infrastructure, and that, I think, for us is a very important success. Also, the conditions, I mean, we were able to get financing of 18, 20 years, which in Colombia, in local terms, was never seen. Before 4G, the maximum maturity was 12 years or 14 years here. Getting 18 to 20 years has been amazing. And internationally also, to be able to mobilize today in the Basel III world, to mobilize 18-year lending in dollars has also been a very successful experience. Even in very interesting conditions between LIBOR plus 2.5 or LIBOR plus 3, which has been also in terms of conditions for us a great success. The other interesting has been the mix of the origin of an international part. I mean, you can see that primarily multilaterals, but also we got a lot of resources coming from the region itself. Whether it's institutional investors from the region, especially the LATAM group, but also from banks from the region. And Asia was probably the three most important regions that have provided funding to the program. Also, we have already started to look at the big charts, you know, the infra-deal statistics. You know, Colombia 4 years ago didn't exist, basically. I mean, it was basically Brazil, Chile, Mexico, the ones really doing inroads and PPP, this is project finance type of deals. We were not in the map, but today we're already in the top, you know, of the countries that actually close eight large project finance road programs, and next year we hope to do 10. So we have suddenly become one of the lead countries doing project finance roads in the region. Ourselves, FDN, we also didn't exist four years ago. We didn't even know what we knew who we are, but now we are starting to be significantly in the charts of financial institutions in the region really specializing in infrastructure. One of the interesting developments and achievements in this first package of financial closings has been the possibility of bringing new players that are specializing in infrastructure. And with it, I think two important improvements that actually has allowed us to bring institutional investors' money into infrastructure. People thought, okay, this is going to be tough because usually institutional investors do not like construction risk. They prefer to come once the project is in operation. To have institutional investors involved during the construction phase was challenging. And with it, the strategy was split in two areas. We decided first to promote specialized institutions called what we call the infra debt funds, where they only do PPP projects in Colombia. There have been three established, all managed by very specialized entities globally, and locally. One was Ashmore and Cav, the other one was Sur Asset Management and Credit Corp from Peru. And the last one, 2 weeks ago, was announced a third fund, which is going to be managed by BlackRock, obviously a very well-known international fund manager. Through those three funds, we have been able to raise already over $1.2 billion, and hopefully we will have a fourth fund, probably by the end of the year, which will add to around $1.7, $1.8 billion. It's interesting because for us, this is like having four new banks. I mean, it's not easy in any market to create out of nothing four new specialized infrastructure banks we have through this mechanism. And did allow pension funds that are very conservative, we didn't have enough experience in project finance or infrastructure, to actually put the money in the hands of people who knows how to do it. So this was an innovative approach, innovative for Colombia and for the context of this program. The other interesting element was the possibility of bringing bonds, buyers of securities, to actually also help financing the construction phase of this program. The program has already issued four bonds, two in dollars, two in local currency. They were all cross-border transactions listed in Luxembourg for $650 million that was raised through those four transactions. But what is interesting is it's the fact that it was the first infrastructure investment grade transaction for Colombia was done through this mechanism. And we have already started to get a lot of prizes, you know, the best road project finance deal of the 2016, both in IJ Global as well as Latin Finance. And here I have to say FDN played a very important role because we were the provider of a credit enhancement that allowed the project to be investment grade. And unfortunately, given the conservative environment of our investors, that was the only way that we could get institutional investors to involve was by making sure the bond was an investment grade transaction. And I think that we will continue to do because we think that's a way of diversifying the sources of finance. In terms of evolution, construction, there are 19 projects now out of the 32, 19 projects that are actually now in construction. Seven that are obviously more advanced, the ones that already got the financial closing are in 12% in advance in the construction. But it's interesting that already 12 of the ones that do not have financial closing are already also starting to make progress. Thanks to the equity contributions they had to do and a few bridge loans that were generated. So 61% of the projects already have work ongoing. And our expected timeline for the rest of the program, for the rest of the 23 projects, we hope to close 10 this year, 8 next year, and the remaining 5, which are the ones that were either awarded at the end or were projects that may be facing some difficulties. And we'll see. Maybe one or two will actually do not go through. But that's for a 32 projects program. I think that's an excellent result. Some of the challenges now to start concluding and finishing. Some of the challenges. Initially, one of the biggest challenges we had were the traditional pre-construction risks, you know, licensing, land acquisition, consultation with communities. That was, at the beginning, our biggest fear for the program. And I have to say today that we have basically overcome mostly that problem. I mean, out of the 32, there are only really 2 projects that are really having significant problems of licensing or consultations. So maybe different from mining and other sectors where they still have significant problems in this area, I think in the area of transport, particularly roads, partly thanks to a very high-level coordination that was established in the country, you know, initially at the vice president level, now has been delegated to the top, to the president itself, that it has a coordination twice a month, you know, to actually oversee the projects, make sure that all of this processes, and this is the bureaucratic part, are being taken care of, and that has actually have effective result that we are today only 2 projects really have significant problems. So that has in some way left the problem a lot in the back. But we have other problems. I mean, we have other problems that we need to resolve, that we have to address. They are more related to the sponsors. Some sponsors got too many projects, and that has generated a bit of concern to the banks. And some projects, a few of them, have sponsors that have some related reputational issues related with some of the scandals. And that's something that we're trying to address clearly, and I'll mention a few things. And on the other side, we have to continue the diversification process. We have to continue to bring multiple sources of finance if we want to make sure the program will not have financing problems. And that in a world of Basel III, in a world where most of the projects are local currency, and therefore there's an issue of foreign FX-related issue, those are our major issues, as well as making sure that our local debt market continues to get more deep. So what are we doing in that area? On the sponsors' concentration and some of the financial weakness of some of the sponsors, one of the advantages of this program, and particularly the contract of the 4G program, is that it makes it quite easy to substitute sponsors, I mean, up to a certain level. I mean, up to the lead sponsor has to remain at least 25% owner, but it facilitates the rest. And that has been something we, the banks, have been pushing, you know, some of the sponsors to actually sell. And so the secondary market of participation has allowed us to strengthen the portfolio of sponsors. and we're going to see it more coming in the next 2 years. There are at least 10 transactions on the way, and I have to say I'm very happy to say that every day we have more and more either sponsors, international sponsors, or financial groups, you know, especially from this part of the world, coming, saying, look, we're interested in buying participations from those sponsors that may have, maybe having some difficulties to put all the equity. We are interested in buying. And we already have institutions like Infrared from this part of the world that have bought participations, and we have several others from all around the world interested in buying, because now they see that the pre-construction risk, the licensing, and the consultations have already gone. So they're interested in coming in now that they can actually, there's more certainty in the timing and the evolution of the project. The other thing that we're doing is, FDN itself, we're developing our equity strategy. We are currently negotiating a very large co-investment operation with a very large international pension fund that I cannot reveal yet, but it's going to be around $1 billion that we're going to raise between them and local funds and FDN, you know, to put to the service of PPP projects in Colombia in different sectors, not only roads, but partly roads, but the other part will go probably to energy and local projects in the cities. The other part on the reputational side, obviously, is a sensitive issue, and this is something that has taken a lot of attention, especially for the local banks. Local banks that were affected by a couple of transactions were, for example, Odebrecht was involved, and they have been affected by that. The government has tried to show that there's very proactive on trying to resolve the situation, try to make sure that the project does not suffer, that the banks do not suffer. I mean, this is not unique to Colombia. It's very large infrastructure projects are always, it's a sector that's always exposed to a bit of excessive interference by private players who want to shortcut. And this is something that we will always be exposed, so we need to learn how to deal with this, how to punish whatever is wrong, but at the same time make sure the projects do not suffer, that the programs do not suffer, and that's something the government is putting together a very fast action to resolve, to liquidate the contract, pay the lenders, and re-license the concession. But we're also introducing regulatory changes in law to make sure that there's a clear process on how to do it in order to avoid uncertainty, which is what has created concern on the local banks. But I will say 4G per se had very high standards of procurement. We haven't had the first problem, you know, of complaints on the way the projects were procured. And we want to keep that standards of procurement for the future projects. I think that and then banks have also strengthening their due diligence and reputational risk. So just to finish, then the current challenge is how we continue to bring more international money when we have local currency issue. So we ourselves are creating a line, a local funding line for international banks so they can lend in pesos, given that the projects are demanding more pesos than dollars because of the nature of the revenues. And we're also promoting the new structures of financing like mini-perms that will allow shorter loans to be implemented and refinanced by capital markets that will allow those shorter maturity loans to be hedged in the international markets and will allow more participation. So we have at least 3 projects now that are introducing this mechanism and will allow international banks to have a bigger participation in the projects that before they were limited by the funding issue. And just we hope at the end that we will have a much more diversified, so in the next 10 projects we expect to have a better mix where we will have a bigger participation of international banks. FDN itself will have also bigger participation. We have been capitalized by the government to have over $1 billion more of capital, so that would allow us to leverage, and that would allow us to have a participation of 15 to 20% in each single project. So that combined with keeping institutional investor participation, we'll have a good mix, and hopefully this will allow the program to continue as it has done already, and for the infrastructure to play the role that it has to play in the coming years. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Clemente, that's very impressive what FDN has actually already achieved in terms of institutional structure itself. You made the point that it's actually a new institution, in a way you're testing the field, and the sheer amount of money that you're able to raise and attract to these projects. You also touched very importantly on a number of environmental and social issues and challenges, which I would like to come back to, because if I remember somewhere in the presentation, you said that a number of projects, even though they've been closed financially, in terms of their implementation, are slowed down because of other processes, and I think that people in the room will be interested to hear more about that. But perhaps, Jorge, I could turn to you first. As one of the major groups who are actually implementing some of these projects, what's your view on this ambition, you know, very high-level ambition? What's happening on the ground? Is there sufficient progress? And what are you doing and what can be done to move things along faster?
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. Honor and pleasure to share the panel with such companions here, so I'm very pleased to be here. Let me start by saying that Colombia has made a tremendous progress as regards to infrastructure, not only on the institutional framework. We've created ANI, we've created the ANLA, we've created the PPP law, the infrastructure law, and many fundamental institutional infrastructure to hold this program, which is the most comprehensive and ambitious program ever the country has achieved. On the question, how do we see things? Let me start by saying that I'm pretty optimistic about the future. I think that in general terms, Latin America is going to have a massive investment in infrastructure in the years to come. If you think that probably 2 billion people is coming into the middle class in the world, 88% of that people will come from emerging countries. And in the Latin American case, basically you're moving from over 300 million people to 650 million people. So that's 2.5 times as many people in the middle class, which actually will demand a lot of infrastructure. And it's not only a number which is important, but it's also the social conscience, I think, that we've got in the country, that the infrastructure is paramount and the primary source not only for competitiveness in the industries and in the country, but also for social inclusion in this part of the world. If you look at the any ranks, the World Economic Forum rank, you'll see Colombia will be in a place like 86 in competitiveness, but it's the 30th economist in the world. So I absolutely agree with Antonio. We need to improve a lot in efficiency, and to be competitive, we need to improve the infrastructure we've got. It's very well known that bringing any ton of cargo, any raw material for the industrial production in Colombia from the Mediterranean basin into the Gulf area of the Caribbean basin will cost anything from $10 to $12 per ton. But shipping that from our ports to the inner cities in the country where the manufacturing actually occurs may cost you $40 to $50. So there's no way that a country can compete with that source of cost in order to transform or to export. So I'm absolutely optimistic. There's a social conscience that we need to tackle this. I think there's a comprehensive set of projects in the future, but of course we have challenges as well.
So if we just go back to you, Clemente, and I'll come to the others in a moment. This issue of social inclusion has been so fundamental to a country that still has profound inequalities, like many others, of course. How does that social inclusion agenda fit into the infrastructure plan as you see it? Can you say just a little bit more about that to explain how that works?
Well, one obviously is improving the connectivity in general of the country. I mean, there has been a significant part of the country that has been very poorly connected because there's no roads. A few airports that have helped, you know, but it's not enough. So clearly that has not been something that has benefited and has actually increased inequality in the country. Again, also now we are starting to look at infrastructure in the cities, because the cities were also a significant problem. For example, the congestions, and this is not only Colombia, you know, emerging markets, new emerging cities are all having problems of traffic and congestions. So there's a need of having bigger investments on massive transportations. That's starting now to become a priority for local governments as well as national governments. So I think the infrastructure now going forward, it has to be a very significant part of our inequality strategy through providing the infrastructure that is needed for the majority of the population that unfortunately has not been adequately covered in the past.
If I'm right, most of the population growth, which is not stratospheric in Colombia, it's a relatively slow growth, will happen in cities, and particularly smaller scale, not just the larger ones. So connecting these cities or improving the infrastructure within the cities and between them becomes important. Hernan, I think you already were singled out as being slightly complaining that not enough attention had been given, in a way, to your industry, both in terms of passenger and cargo. What are your thoughts about this program? What should it be doing next? And again, how can it help this, you know, wider project of connecting the country to itself and to other parts?
Well, thank you, Ricky, and thank you to the LSE for hosting us. Delighted to be here. There's an irony on my industry, which is my number one challenge is ground operations, which is strange for an airline to say. And it's not just in Colombia. My number one challenge to operate the airline is ground operations in every airport that I go to, including Heathrow, by the way. And I think all of you know the whole debate in Heathrow about the third runway has been going on for 15 years, and it will be another 10 years until we get the third one, right? Yeah. Well, that situation happens worldwide, and the reason is simple. Air travel has taken off, and infrastructure has not been able to keep up with the numbers. Just to illustrate, in Colombia, in the last 11 years, the number of passengers has tripled. It's very difficult to have the infrastructure to support that. Although I have to say that about 10 years ago, Colombia woke up and began an important investment process. It's not a lot of money. It's about $1.5 billion invested over the last 5 years. Beginning with the Bogota airport, which is, of course, the hub for Colombia. But it has not been enough, and it's not enough. When the Bogota airport opened in 2012, it was designed for 20 million passengers. Well, that year, we had 25 million passengers. So the day that we opened, we were already short. There has been a further investment of about $400 million. Which is just about to open. For those of you that are familiar with the Bogota airport, is the north terminal and the south terminal. One of them will be the south terminal, will be fully domestic, and the north terminal is an extension to the international, which is very much welcome. But by the time we open later this year, the capacity of the airport will be about 38 million passengers, and we'll have 40 million passengers. So we have not been able to catch up. And I use Bogota only as an illustration. If you go to La Guardia, I don't know if anybody has been to La Guardia recently, it's a chaos. Yeah. There are no gates, there are no access. So that's what's holding back airlines like Avianca and every single airline. As I said before, ground transportation is our headache. It's not buying brand new aircraft. There is plenty of brand new aircraft, very efficient. There's plenty of money to do that. Passengers are willing to go. Passengers are willing to pay. Airports are what is constraining, and it's a huge opportunity everywhere in the world.
So what would you like FDN or the government through FDN to actually do? mean, if that's the problem, what's missing at the moment?
What is missing is a sense of urgency. There is a debate now in Colombia about whether or not we should build a second airport. There is no doubt about that. We have to build. I have to begin now, so that 10 years from now, when we open a second airport in Bogota, we'll be ready to operate at that capacity. So more investment, not only from the government. About half of the investment in airports in Colombia has been done by the private sector, in good partnerships. And we have a partnership with Jorge because he owns the Bogota airport, and I am the largest client of his at the airport. That's what's needed.
I didn't know you were that close.
I'll get back to that.
On this point, why don't we raise, Clemente, the I'll come to you in a moment, the issue of, you know, the environmental question, airplanes and other forms of infrastructure, including roads, create pollution, can contribute to that. That was the big discussion, one of the biggest issues about air quality, in terms of what happens to London when a third runway happens at Heathrow as opposed to Gatwick. How are those issues actually being considered? Because I think you're all concerned in our previous conversations, what I've read about it, that actually, the environmental agenda has to be taken seriously. There was an interesting question at the previous panel, but they can be seen to delay things. I mean, how is that being taken into account? Is that a major risk as far as you're concerned? Are you dealing with it in a sort of holistic way?
Well, there has been improvements. Clearly, at the beginning, we had delays generated by the time it takes to get the license and approve. I think the currently, at least in transport, I mean, I cannot talk about mining, but in transport, the consultations with the communities have actually become one of the biggest challenges because constitutionally, obviously, there has to be a consultation with the communities that could be affected by the project, and there has to be an agreed compensation for those communities that could be affected. However, the process in Colombia has not been properly ruled. I mean, the framework is not properly in place, and that has allowed a lot of abuse of the process, abused by communities that do not exist, that suddenly appears in areas where there were two communities, they were consulted, they got the license, but suddenly two new communities appear out of the air. And because of the legal framework we have, they have been given power by the law, by the judges, and have stopped projects. And that has given them more incentive to abuse because they can get things by basically stopping projects. I think that's something that we have to continue to improve because, it's fair, the consultation has to be done. It's fair the communities that are really affected should be compensated. But we cannot allow this abuse to take place. And I think that's where the framework needs to be improved. There is a project to reglament, I don't know if I'm inventing the Spanish, regulate, I mean, this is like Spanglish, to regulate the process. Hopefully the government will present it in the next few months, will present this project of law that will put more rules and more clarity, hopefully to avoid the abuses, because that will continue to be an issue if it doesn't get properly regulated.
Right. I'll come to Philippe in a moment. Jorge, you wanted to comment?
Just wanted to get back to the airport thing, because I agree with Hernandez. There's a huge opportunity for Colombia and for the private and public sector to partner in a way in which we can absolutely coordinatedly tackle this problem. Let me just briefly explain where we were, what we are doing right now, what are the short things that we could grab together, the low-hanging fruits that we could grab, and the long-term view from our side. First, absolutely, the airport has grown at a 14% CAGR over the last 10 years. It's moving 32 million passengers. It's the third largest airport in Latin America. And we are currently investing $150 million in order to do a couple of things. We are expanding 47,000 square meters in the terminal. And just to give you an idea, the entire airport in 2007, it was designed, was 50,000 square meters. So we are adding exactly the same size of terminal as the one we had 10 years ago. We are putting up 40% more bridges and gates into the service, and that will take the airport to close to 40 million passengers capacity. But that's not enough. I absolutely agree. But there's a lot of things that together we can do in order to make the most efficient investment for the country. You have to bear in mind that the private concessionaire is just administrating a public asset that's a national asset. So if we work together, we implement the ILS systems, the approach electronic systems, the low visibility procedures with two runways, Heathrow run 75 million passengers a year, and we are doing 32. So yes, we can do it. If we have the coordination and we work together, and in the long term, I absolutely agree with Ron. We have to look forward for a different approach. We'll need another airport. The one that we are currently operating will be at full capacity in 10, 15 years' time. So we need to think
Let's move on from the fundamental issue of connectivity, which is the base of your presentation, both on the ground and in the air, to the very substantial issue of quality of life, livability, and progress in the most general sense, which is power. Having access to power, to electricity, to gas, for everyone, must be an ambition for all, not just the new middle classes, but everyone who lives in your country, both in the city and in rural areas. Atok Ecopetrol, you have now new discoveries, if I'm right, of gas in the Caribbean areas. How are you fitting into this infrastructure sort of plan set up by Clemente, and what are the major areas of growth and investment? Also in distribution, and again connecting to, let's call it, the social agenda, which I think is relevant.
So thank you, and thanks for the opportunity of being here today. And I think if you go back to the first conversation we're listening to in the panel about growth and how do we see the medium and long term, clearly to fuel the economy, we need the petrol, we need the gasoline, we need the diesel, and we need the gas, and we need the cleaner
fuels.
Not too
much diesel.
No, well, depends on where you are, but we move the trucks that will eventually use the roads with the diesel. So we need to ensure that we provide low sulfur diesel that we can't produce in our new refinery in Cartagena. And for that, we have, I think, several things that we need to do. As people aspire to move in society and have that upward mobility, you need to be able to ensure that you keep on investing in country. So there's a few things we've done, and we see we have a role in playing. The first one is clearly infrastructure around downstream and midstream, so ensuring that you have the pipelines to take your crude and products, but also refine those products. Over the last 10 years or decade, we've invested close to $20 billion in that area, so that's being able to have clean products that fuel growth. But also I think we need to invest in ensuring that energy security is something that the country can have, as it has all this growth agenda that we've talked about. This year we're investing $3.5 billion. We've made some good discoveries in gas, but we need to be mindful that those will take 8 to 10 years before those molecules actually see the markets, you know, and there needs to be a joint work with the distributors and with the transportation companies and around regulation, around some of the consultations with the communities to ensure that we can get those molecules. And at the end of the day, not only for Colombia, but also for the export. So a big role in ensuring that we have the capacity to refine and transfer the products around the country, but also to ensure that mid and long term, we find hydrocarbons that can feed the refineries, but can also feed the gas system, which is quite massive. But we do believe that there's still opportunity to further grow the gas market
in the country.
Do you feel there is sufficient joined-up thinking across the different levels of generating energy, its distribution, its transport mechanism, or are you saying more can be done?
And I'll share.
What should Clemente take away from this?
Yeah, and I'll share a story. You know, I recently visited Singapore and had the opportunity of talking to some of the people that were fundamental in these 50 years of independence of Singapore. And they were saying, look, in Singapore, we don't have oil, we don't have gas, we don't have land. We need to buy the sand and bring it in country so we can reclaim from the ocean. We don't have food and we don't have water. In Colombia, you have everything. The key thing that you need to do is to ensure that you have a joint up vision of the country that you have, you want to have in 10 or 15 years from now. So I think back to some of the conversations we're listening in the earlier panels to what Clemente is doing at FDN, we need to ensure that we can joint up behind that vision. Okay. You know?
Now, we have just a few more minutes before I open up to the floor. There are two questions that might be worth considering. They're not necessarily connected, sometimes they are. And you implied certainly one of them, corruption. And the second is pollution. Sometimes they're connected, not always. I'd like to hear from you how you all, I mean, you're very sensitive to this issue. And I think there's a concern that despite the ambition, despite how far you've got, you know, the market, put it broadly, might find it difficult to invest because of not understanding what the processes are, and some stories of corruption, issues of refineries, etc. I don't need to go into those in detail. How much is that an issue from your industry's perspective? Or in terms of, I guess, risk reduction, in terms of the image that Colombia puts forward to the global markets?
Well, I think it's a very sensitive and top priority for corporations in general. I would say that what actually happened in Colombia, if you look in general terms, the Colombian process in infrastructure has been very transparent, very, very transparent as compared to many other countries. First point. The second one, in the cases where there's sign of corruption, I'm fully support what Clemente said. It should be investigated, it should be punished, and we should raise the bar as the clauses that are implied in the contracts for civil construction of public works. But corruption not only happens on the public sector, it does happen between private and public many times. And what I would like to highlight is that most of the Colombian corporations and companies are very honest, sensitive to good governance practices. So I think what's got to be done is to raise the bar, to higher the standards in corporate governance, to have not only codes on how you behave, codes on how you contract, strengthening the auditing process, but also having internal measures like, I would say something we've done is that the CEO and the vice presidents of the corporations will have to declare their incomes on yearly basis to the auditing committee that reports to the board. And that's a Transparency Act to support the...
Sorry. Felipe first and then...
Thanks. So... I think that clearly there can't be any complacency with corruption, you know, altogether. And as you were highlighting, there's been a lot of spotlights put on the refinery, the new refinery, and clearly there were cost overruns. And I'd say two things. The first one is that we need to ensure that we provide all the support to the authorities and agencies that are investigating, and they'll need to get to the final consequences of those, which is absolutely fine. On the other hand, we need to ensure that we build from what I think it's one of the, or probably the largest industrial complex in country, and make sure that we provide the opportunity for it to generate all the value that the country needs. So it's both things. And building on Jorge, I think we as businessmen need to ensure that we're transparent. We don't allow things to happen. We're very
straightforward in how we do our dealings, and jointly as a society we need to ensure that we get to that place. And at the end of the day, most of our companies are listed in places like New York, for example. Yeah. And we need to comply with those regulations as well.
No question that corruption is an issue that you have to be watchful for. In the way it manifests itself in a company like Avianca is on the risk of drug trafficking and money laundering. And being listed in New York has an incredible side effect, which is that we are subject to the Foreign Corruption Act of the United States. And that gives us a lot of tools to work with the authorities in the United States, in Spain, in the UK, wherever we travel, and with the Colombian authorities to keep a watch on that. But this is an everyday situation. You know, the opportunity is there, the temptation is there. You have to be very strong educating your employees on how to deal with that. The temptation is there, they're approached, obviously. Pilots, flight attendants are approached. So you have to have a very strong training to prevent it. Of course, you have to combat that at the other end, but preventing it is what is key for us.
I think we should use the few minutes left to get some statements, comments, questions from the floor. There are 25 hands up, that's great.
That's a good sign.
And what I'd like to do is maybe get three comments together. And then at the end, if again, as Tim did before, choose one of the questions to comment on rather than all of them, otherwise we will run out of time. So let's start with the gentleman here, then the other gentleman there, and then the woman at the, near the back. Let's have those three. One, two, and three.
Thank you for your presentation. My name is Nicolas Oyeda. I'm currently finishing my master's here in the LSE. My question is to Felipe. Taking into account that there is still certain flaws or challenges that regulation, well, that the energy sector needs to overcome in terms of firm energy supply, and taking into account that the regulation has not been good enough to avoid situations like the one of Termo Candelaria, I would like to know what do you think needs to be done in terms of regulation and things like cargo por confiabilidad to avoid these kind of situations and have a firm energy supply in the long run and not only in those moments in which we have enough hydro capacity to cover the demand of energy in the country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please say who you are.
Oscar Ramirez from Queen Mary University of London. I have a question regarding mining and oil and gas licenses or concession. Which is the approach from policy and private investment to address the likely disconnection that there is between international oil and gas companies or mining companies and national governments and local governments and communities about social license to operate. So there is an approach, and in the university we have conducted research about how, for example, in Australia, there is a process of concessions in mining sectors and oil and gas. Basically, they have two approaches. For legal instability, they have state mining agreements that is directly negotiations between the state and between the companies, and they can afford stability from a point of view regarding different issues. And second, a normal license that is more connected to the local community, so the agencies of granting these concessions are located in the locations. That's my point.
Thank you. The question's been asked, okay? So let's go. The gentleman right at the back with his hand up behind the lady with the yellow sweater.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for your presentations. My name's Neil McNevin. I know Ricky, we worked together on the London 2012 program, and I've had the pleasure to visit your country a number of times with the British government. I have my own business, Paragon Regeneration. And one of the key lessons that I learned in terms of being encouraged to go across with the government and meeting your colleagues is what lessons can be learned from the UK and some of our large infrastructure programs. And something that struck me absolutely when Clemente said about the challenges that you were having, pre-construction issues, licensing, land acquisition. And that's actually a world that I'm a specialist in as a charter planner. And my question is, are you aware of the British nationally significant infrastructure projects, particularly in the transport sector? We call them NSIPs. And if not, I'd be very happy to discuss. But we must, you are here in our country, and we have issues with Heathrow and other major infrastructure projects. We must learn from each other.
Okay. We will do that, but maybe not as a result of this discussion. Wait, let's go for one gentleman right in the middle there. Yeah. And then right in there. Thank you, in the middle. Very brief, please, and then more.
I'll be brief. Nathan Piper, I work for Royal Bank of Canada, looking at the oil and gas sector there. So specifically to infrastructure and the peace process, how much progress have you made in implementing infrastructure expansion into areas such as the Putumayo, where the FARC are most prevalent, and therefore really backing up the peace process? Because I guess the big risk on the peace process is not enough progress is made and people revert back to making money in ways which don't require good transport links.
Thank you very much. So should we start with you and just end with you, Clemente? And you may want to add some final thoughts on the issues that we've been discussing, but pick up on one of the questions.
Well, I'll probably refer to the last one regarding the infrastructure for the peace process. I think our country has a great challenge and a big opportunity to build the infrastructure that's necessary to cop the areas where the guerrillas were fighting for 52 or more years. There's an absence of infrastructure in those parts of the country, and there's a direct relationship between the quality and number of roads and infrastructure, not only roads, but schools and health services and everything, to the conflicts. So we need to build something. There are some initiatives going on which I think are going to be important for the country. We recently launched one called 51 times 50, which means there's going to be 50 municipalities in the rural areas of the country that are going to build 51 kilometers or tertiary roads for which special products and design must be accomplished. I think there's a huge opportunity there.
Interesting. I'll comment on the question or comment on the environment, which is, this is an industry issue. Significant improvement has been made and is being made on the efficiency of the engines, which is a critical component. But there are limits, technical limits. And I think the only long-term solution is the electrical engine, which is a totally different technology. It's about 10 years away. That's where we're headed as an industry.
So I'll pick a couple of things that were mentioned. One, in terms of just the power security overall, in terms of ensuring that we can underpin growth but having enough power in country. And I think that a lot has been done over the last 2-3 years. I mean, recently with what Antonio and his company did with the LNG regas terminal, it's ensuring that we have underpinned, should we need it, additional sources. We have connectivity with Venezuela. We found some more gas reserves. So I think mid-long term, we're in good shape. Traditionally, Colombia has been known as a country that honors its commitments. You know, and from a legal point of view and the legal security point of view, businesses have done very well. Having said that, I do agree that some of the recent consultas populares and some of the other initiatives in some of the areas do provide some shadows and probably some concern and apprehension. So I think it's something that we need to address. Mm-hmm. It's something that people have the right to actually express their minds and share their views, and some people may decide they don't want extractive industries in their areas. But back to, I think, something we heard from the first panel, we'll need to decide then how people actually participate in the benefits of those industries overall.
Well, okay, and that maybe you can have a more detailed conversation with the gentleman.
I'm sure.
Later. Clemente, over to you.
Well, I'll mention two things. One, complementing the answer on power, it's true that Colombia was too proud to rely heavily on water because it was clean, and that's why Colombia was always complying very generously with all the targets. However, it's also true that at some point water can be scarce, and we've had a couple of situations where that happened, and we were not properly prepared. I mean, the framework was too skewed towards firm energy, and that was excluding in some way all the renewables. Now we have learned the of mistake, and we're trying to recover that. We're trying to introduce a new framework to try to stimulate renewables, particularly wind and solar, and hopefully Colombia will start having at least a percentage of its energy system relying also on renewables, and I think that's very important. And just to end, related to the UK experience, for us, I really think one of the biggest challenges is how we not only improve the planning of projects, how we plan in advance for the pipeline, to build a pipeline, and that needs strengthening the institutional side and the planning side. It's weak there. But the other part is the political interference, because politics in Colombia, at least, is 4-year periods. Building and developing pipeline takes 8 or 10 years. So we're always exposed to this lack of stability in the pipeline generation. So we need, I mean, I know that the UK is working on the same area, how you can create some framework that will protect projects from the political cycle. We need to do something similar. So hopefully the lessons from the UK can be used, and hopefully we learn about it.
And I think it is true that there are major projects, major infrastructure projects, rail and others, being developed here, but certainly the joined-up thinking still, I think, has a long way to go in terms of integrating infrastructure investment and provision with social and environmental issues. But that's a question we all face. Before joining me and thanking the panelists, it's very uplifting, I have to say, just as Tim in the previous panel ended by talking about the peace dividend, to actually begin to think about infrastructure in the context of what it can do. Your 51 by 50 was a very interesting example of how to connect a sort of a new political and social context with a very physical aspect of infrastructure investment, financially essential to the well-being of the country. Can you please thank all four panelists?
Thank you to Ricky, Clemente, and all the panelists. There is some coffee outside. I can't promise it's Colombian, but it is fair trade, so your ethics.